Good morning. This is Impact Cincinnati on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. For weeks, Cincinnati's plan to lease its parking meters and garages has been tangled up in court, and that will continue since a judge yesterday extended a temporary restraining order for two more weeks. This morning, we're going to talk about how the idea for the plan came about, where it stands now, and everything in between. Joining me are WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. He's covered every aspect of this case, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. We'd like to hear your questions and comments. You can email them to impact@wvxu.org or post them on our Facebook page. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it's been a busy few weeks as we've been learning all about this parking, and I think what we'd like to do today is really sort through the whole thing and start as far at the beginning as we possibly can. And I think a good place to start is to talk about why Cincinnati City Council even got to the point where they're considering leasing their parking. And Jay, maybe you can explain.
Well, for almost, and Howard, if I say anything wrong, you can correct me, but generally for almost a decade, the city has had a structurally unbalanced budget. And Milton Dehoney, since he came here in 2006, has been trying to figure out new ways to get revenue, as he says, into the government.
Now he's city manager.
City manager. And he's proposed different a trash fee. He's proposed ending the property tax rollback, a couple of other ideas, and council has never been willing to give him that new revenue. He's also proposed a series of budget cuts, major layoffs in the past. Council has also not approved any of those budget cutting measures. So I think it was last year the Ohio legislature passed a law that allowed cities to franchise or lease out their parking meters. And so when the city manager saw that as a revenue opportunity, he presented it in his budget proposal that came out in November of last year. Council approved it in December.
Why do you think they approved this after having not approved anything else?
I think they're kind of running out of options. And along the way, there have also been, you know, even as the manager says, we need to bring more revenue into the government, it's been losing revenue. Local government fund, that the money that comes from the state to the city, has been reduced. The Ohio legislature eliminated the estate tax, and that cost Cincinnati revenue. And there are some council members that say, you know, without the cut to the local government fund and the loss of the estate tax, the city's budget for this year would have been balanced. I think that was like a $20 million hit from those two sources. So they've got to have revenue.
And he sees this as a way of plugging budget holes through 2015, right?
Right. And to be clear, this does not completely solve the general fund budget deficit. It helps.
Yeah.
$25 million of the parking lease would balance the budget that's coming up, but there's still a $10 million gap that will have to be closed for the fiscal year, I think it's 2014, that would start on July 1st.
So let's talk about the plan itself, because there are certainly a lot of people opposed to it, and we'll talk about what they're doing to try to make this not happen here shortly. But what are the aspects of the plan, and what are the controversial parts of it? Or is the whole thing controversial?
I think the whole thing is controversial.
Yeah, from top to bottom, it's controversial.
Essentially, the city put out requests for proposals, and I can't remember if they got 7 responses or 9 responses. That had varying amounts of this large upfront payment. And that upfront payment is what's going to help to stabilize the budget through 2015.
$92
million. $92 million. And there were, I think, there maybe was even one proposal that was upwards of $150 million or more, but that was a completely private operator. So essentially what they did after they got these requests for proposals, they sat down with the Port Authority, the Greater Cincinnati Port Authority, the city did, and basically negotiated an agreement with them to keep it with the Port Authority, thinking that that would make it a little bit better, because the Port Authority itself is a public entity. Its members are appointed by Cincinnati and Hamilton County.
And this is why the city manager and the supporters on council are saying this is not privatization, because the Port Authority is a public entity.
And there would also be an advisory board that would be in place. The city manager or his representative would be one of, I think there's 5 members on the board. The city manager or one of his appointees would have one seat. The Port Authority would assign the other 4.
Now, when we talk about all of this, and this plan and how it works, I think it's important to point out, I think a lot of people, when you think of parking meters in Cincinnati, you think about downtown and parking garages downtown. But this is not just about downtown.
No, this is parking meters anywhere in the city, in the neighborhoods, in the neighborhood business districts, and downtown. It's all the parking meters in the city. It includes 5 city-owned garages and 3 city-owned lots. Now, there are some parking garages and lots that are exempt. I know the garage under Fountain Square is exempt, and also the new garage under Washington Park exempt, because those are both managed by 3CDC. And the garage that we're familiar with, the Town Center garage next to CET, is also exempt because a lot of the City Hall employees park in that lot during the business day.
And this would be, the Port Authority would lease this to a private company. Private company would actually operate, you know, the parking meters and the garages.
Right. The Port Authority is basically who the lease is going to be issued to. The lease agreement would be between the City of Cincinnati and the Port Authority. But the Port Authority is going to essentially sub out the management of the parking system to other companies. And that would be, there's a firm called AEW. They're the overall asset manager. They watch over all the assets. Xerox would be in charge of the day-to-day operation of the on-street parking meters. Denison would manage the off-street parking or the parking lots and garages. And then a firm called Guggenheim would be the underwriter and the capital provider, and that is who would issue the bonds that would generate the $92 million, which represents the upfront payment to the city as part of the lease.
One thing I want to point out that you've done before when I've talked to you about this, Xerox is not the copier company.
I said that, but I'm not sure about that now.
Okay.
So I think it might be a subsidiary of the company that we think of for copiers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about this $92 million upfront payment, and then what kind of money is expected to be brought into the city beyond that?
I believe that their figure is about $3 million a year, give or take, for the lease term. And there are actually two leases. There's the lease for the parking meters, which is 30 years, and then the garages and lots are a 50-year lease.
Okay, so it's interesting, and a lot of people have questioned this, that if the city's going to be getting that much money, but these organizations are still willing to be involved, they're obviously going to be making money too. Why can't the city just make more money and run it itself? Why are they saying this is a better deal?
And that's an argument that council members make, that the some council members who oppose the lease make, that, you know, the city could do the same thing. I think the people who support this say the city probably couldn't operate it the way these operators are going to do it. These people know how to operate parking facilities, and they also have the ability with this, basically, with the upfront payment, the city is getting all of its money at once, because the bonds are being for this will be held by the Port Authority. The city doesn't have the bonding capacity to bring in $92 million all at once.
Yeah, and Xerox does this in about 30 cities around the country. I mean, so they know what they're doing.
So it's just a matter of the experience that they have. And so this $92 million helps plug the budget hole. But also there's some talk about another parking garage coming down and some construction downtown. Where would this money be spent also?
Roughly half of it, and it might be a little bit more than half, but roughly half of it goes to the budget stabilization. They're also they would also put up $20 million to be the city's match for the project that would build an interchange on Martin Luther King Drive at 71. That's been a project that's been discussed for some time. And the other thing, too, with that, if for some reason that relies on funding also from the Ohio Department of Transportation, if for some reason ODOT decided not to do that project, the manager says, okay, well, we'll use that $20 million elsewhere in those communities near where that interchange would be. $12 million would go to the project that you were talking about to remake Tower Place Mall, and also tear down the old Pogue's Garage at 4th and Race, and that's where you would have the proposed new parking garage and the 30-story building that would have some retail and also upscale apartments.
And a grocery store, too.
And a grocery store. There's also $3 million that they set aside to purchase the Wasson Line right-of-way. Some council members have advanced a project there that would make an off-street bike path that would serve several neighborhoods along that Wasson Line. And then $4 million would be set aside to continue work on the Smale Riverfront Park that's part of the Banks Project.
And Howard, the whole politics of all of this and how it shakes down, why are the folks opposed, and what is this going to mean as we look forward?
Well, I think they're opposed to it for many reasons. I mean, they say, you know, if you turn it over to a private operator, that private operator is going to be highly motivated to go around and write a lot of parking tickets to recoup what they've invested.
So the money that the company uses to make is not really from the 50 cents a dollar that people are putting in the meter so much as it is for people that don't put any money in the meter and they're
the city will counter that argument, though, that these companies are being paid a flat fee.
Right.
It doesn't matter one parking ticket or 200 parking tickets, they're going to get the same amount of money.
But nonetheless, that's the political argument that they're making, that these people are going to be highly motivated to go out and write zillions of tickets, you know, in order to recoup the money that they've invested.
And another argument it is, even though it's spelled out in the lease that parking rates are capped at either the higher of the consumer price index or 3% a year, whichever one of those is greater, there are still some who say, you know, there's ways around that, you know, if things aren't going well and they need to increase rates, they'll figure out a way to increase rates higher than, you know, that guarantee that's spelled out in the agreement.
And there's a lot of objections to the fact that the parking meters would be in effect until 9 p.m. instead of 5 p.m., and that could hurt businesses, particularly downtown and in the neighborhoods, you know, where people park on the street for free after 5 p.m.
And one thing we should say about rates, even though, you know, they are capped at CPI or 3%, for the parking meters, they have to increase in quarter increments. So, you know, if the CPI takes it up, let's say, to 6 cents, you're not going to have, you know, 75 cents plus 6 cents. You're not going to worry about nickels and dimes and pennies to plug the meters. They have to go in quarter increments. And the way that would work out now, I think the city manager said the first increase in downtown meter rates would be in 2015, and 2019 would be the first increase in the neighborhoods. Although the neighborhoods would increase once they start installing some of these smarter meters around the neighborhoods. It would go to 75 cents an hour, and I think right now it's 50 cents an hour.
And the smart meters are the ones you can use your credit card.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about where the case stands now and how it's in court and what's going to happen with it. And we'd certainly like to hear from you, too. If you have a question or a comment, email us, impact@wvxu.org, or post your question on our Facebook page.
Support comes from the Cincinnati Ballet, presenting Prodigal Son, March 22nd and 23rd at the Aronoff. This narrative masterpiece, created by the legendary George Balanchine, is set to the Prokofiev score performed live. Prodigal Son also features two other pieces, the contemporary piece Extremely Close and the world premiere of Concerto No. 4. Tickets 513-621-5282 or cballet.org.
Support comes from the Taft Museum of Art. This Thursday at 7 p.m., the Taft invites you to join renowned painter and collector of art David C. Driscoll speaking on Career Collecting Collection. David C. Driscoll in his own words. The current exhibition, African American Art Since 1950, Perspectives from the David C. Driscoll Center, is on view. TaftMuseum.org or 241-0343.
Support comes from Green Bean Delivery, an online home delivery service for organic produce and natural groceries, creating an avenue for local farmers and artisans. Green Bean Delivery strives to make healthy, local, and sustainably grown foods affordable, accessible, and convenient for all of Greater Cincinnati. For more information, visit greenbeandelivery.com.
This is Impact Cincinnati at 91.7 WVXU. We're talking this morning about the Cincinnati parking lease issue. And my guests are WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. He's pretty much covered every aspect of this case. And WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Again, if you have a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you. Send them to impact@wvxu.org or post them on our Facebook page. So the city council voted and passed this plan, and it's not yet being put into place. And why is that?
Well, city council passed this plan on March 6th, a little after, give or take, right around 4 o'clock on March the 6th. And within minutes, opponents of the plan were waiting in Judge Robert Winkler's courtroom to ask for a temporary restraining order. And literally, right after the council votes, Judge Winkler signed a restraining order that prevented the city from moving forward with the parking lease until he could hold a hearing on whether there should be a permanent injunction to block the city from moving forward.
Now, why would they want to block it through the courts? I mean, lots of times you just put a referendum on the ballot.
Well, because it was passed by an emergency clause, and that has pretty much shut down, you know, the opportunity for referendums in the past.
So explain what an emergency clause is.
An emergency clause is an added to an ordinance so it can take effect immediately. Normally when a council acts on an ordinance, it will take effect 30 days after it's published in the city's bulletin. An emergency law, basically an emergency ordinance, once the mayor signs it, it is in effect. And the emergency was attached so that the city manager could immediately sign the lease agreement with the Port Authority.
But they were in the courtroom, so they've stopped it for now. The temporary restraining order was put in place for 2 weeks.
And that was on March 6th. And Judge Winkler held a hearing last Friday to hear arguments on the permanent injunction. And the temporary restraining order was scheduled to expire yesterday at 4 o'clock and about noontime yesterday. He signed an extension that now takes that temporary restraining order out until April the 3rd. Although the city lawyers seem to think that he will probably issue a decision on the preliminary injunction before April the 3rd.
But the case took a little side trip to another court in the process.
Originally, when the plaintiffs filed their case in court, they filed a federal claim of a civil rights violation. And essentially, when that was scheduled, the city tried to transfer the case to federal court because of that federal issue in the case. When it went to federal court, the plaintiffs removed the federal civil rights voting violation, and so it was transferred back to state court.
This question's from Steve. He says, how can the city of Cincinnati implement this plan, a plan of this magnitude, without going to the public for a vote?
Well, they could if somebody hadn't walked into court and filed for a temporary restraining order through the emergency clause.
I think his question is, though, can the city make these kinds of decisions on their own without taking a vote? Is that common practice?
No, I mean, they took a vote.
I'm sorry, a vote of the people.
Oh, I see.
A public vote.
Well, that gets to a really complex argument because, you know, in fact, we live in a representative democracy. We elect people to make decisions for us and make decisions on laws and ordinances and bills. And if we don't like it, generally the remedy is the next election. And if we don't like what they've done, we can unelect them. But this is a different case. This is a case where, you know, they're trying to do this through the courts, trying to get a referendum established on an ordinance that was passed under the emergency clause, which is highly unusual.
And that literally is, I mean, you can sum up the court argument right there. Proponents of the plan to put it on the ballot say that the city charter gives them the right to referendum any question that city council approves. The city's argument is, yeah, in most cases that's true, except and then they go to state law that says that you cannot referendum an emergency ordinance or any ordinance that has an appropriation or that spends money.
That's correct.
And they argue that this was an emergency ordinance and it's not subject to referendum. And they very specifically use the same language that Howard used, that if you don't like what they did, you have your opportunity in November to unelect those people who supported this.
And it's a fact. We as citizens do not get to vote on every piece of legislation that's passed by a city council, a state legislature, or Congress. We just don't.
This question's from Maria, and she wants to know, how will the leasing of the parking meters affect those who work for the city as parking attendants? How many employees are going to lose their jobs, and how many will be gained by leasing out the parking?
Any of the represented employees, and I think they're all represented by the AASHMEE union, the city has an agreement with AASHMEE that if this lease is approved, all of the current city employees, if they choose not to go with the new operators of the parking facilities, will be offered other jobs within the city government. So any of the current AASHMEE represented employees, if they choose not to go with the new parking operator, will still have a job within the city, just somewhere else.
Now,
and I think that Guggenheim or the parking operators were planning on maybe hiring about 40 people to manage the parking meters. I'm not sure about the garages.
Now, if this doesn't go through, if the opponents win in court and it doesn't go through, what does this mean for the city's budget?
Immediately, it has a $25.8 million hole that has to be closed by July the 1st.
And the city manager has said he'll do what to do that?
He has his plan B, which includes layoffs for 344 people and then some various other cuts along the way.
This is from Greg, and it's more of a comment. Maybe you guys can help us figure out if this is exactly accurate. He says, another reason the city wants to lease the asset is that it provides money that is not then under restrictions set by state law that limit parking revenues. And by leasing it, they avoid a restriction and can put the money into the general budget. Is that true?
That, for the most part, is true. Yeah, the parking, right. Parking is considered an enterprise fund or restricted fund. So the parking revenues that the city collects now from meters and garages has to go back into the parking system. By doing it the lease way, the money is opened up to the general fund.
Right.
And there are some on council who think that they could make some subtle changes to do that anyway. But again, it wouldn't be the large influx of cash that they get from the parking lease.
Howard, let's talk a little bit about the political fallout for all of this. This was supposed to be done and settled and taken care of pretty quickly, so some members of council thought. It's getting dragged out, and we're getting closer and closer, not only to the election for council, but to the primary for the mayor's race in Cincinnati.
Well, if they thought this was going to be settled very quickly, then they're delusional. there was clearly great opposition to this. We saw it at the public hearings, where people turned out in great numbers to speak out against this. Obviously, you had the lawsuit filed for the temporary restraining order immediately. You had various groups, diverse groups, like Citizens Opposed to Additional Spending and Taxes, Coast, the NAACP, lots of West Side activists, merchants, get involved in trying to stop this thing. It was clearly politically unpopular when they did it, and I think they're smart enough to know that.
And the other thing, too, that makes this a little bit unique is until this year, the city's budget was from January 1st until December 31st, and the city asked state lawmakers to be able to switch to a fiscal year. So starting this year, the new budget year will run from July 1 until June 30th. And what that means is that any budget decisions, any layoffs, any budget reductions, any tax increases, any revenue increases have to be voted on before the council election. Typically what has happened, the council members were elected in November, they took office in December, and the budgets were decided before the end of the year. So now, and then you had, some period of time before they had to go back to the voters. Now those decisions are being made before the election.
Right, and that's highly unusual. They've avoided like the plague making these kind of budget decisions in an election season.
So is it going to become a very heated election because of this?
I think it will be. I think it's
not that it wasn't going to be anyway.
I mean, I don't know what the ultimate outcome of this is going to be in the courts, because whatever Judge Winkler decides is going to go to the First District Court of Appeals. It could go on to the Ohio Supreme Court.
I find it very unlikely that this case does not end up before the Ohio Supreme Court.
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly where it's headed. And it's going to be an issue in this campaign for the candidates who either voted for this plan in council or support it. And, you've got two mayoral candidates in Roxanne Qualls and John Cranley who are on opposite sides of this issue. Cranley is leading the opposition, and Qualls has been a supporter of this thing, so it's going to have an enormous impact on this election.
Realistically, when you say you think it's going to get as far as the Ohio Supreme Court, courts don't tend to move particularly quickly. How long could that take? I mean, could it even be after the election that it's decided?
What I've been told that is if it goes to the Ohio Appeals Court, that even on an expedited docket, that's probably going to take 3 to 4 weeks. And that pushes, if Judge Winkler, let's say, rules April the 3rd, whichever side loses is going to appeal to the Ohio Court of Appeals. That decision may come sometime early May. And then, the losing side there could appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court. I guess it's possible there could be a decision before the election, but even the election doesn't matter as much as what the city's going to have to do to balance the budget by July 1st.
So if this isn't settled, they really have to deal with the budget.
If they don't get a decision in their favor, I would say by the first part of May, they're going to go forward with the budget without the parking revenue, at least for the time being.
They're going to have to. They have no choice.
And because the union contracts, if there are going to be layoffs, some of the unions require 60 days notice before layoffs. So if you're dealing with a deadline of July 1st, literally layoff notices would have to be issued around May 1st for some of the unions.
This question's from Jim. He says, a few years ago, then Chicago Mayor Richard Daley worked a deal to privatize parking revenues in Chicago. It's been as Jim says, a complete disaster for both the city and particularly its citizens. Current Mayor Rahm Emanuel is trying to figure out a way out of the deal. Is anyone in the Cincinnati administration even aware of the Chicago situation and how it might relate to the proposed plan?
The city manager is very aware of the Chicago situation. As a matter of fact, when he did his PowerPoint presentation, he has a slide, "This is not Chicago." And he points out there are several differences. In Cincinnati, control rests with the Port Authority, which, again, we've said is a public entity. In Chicago, control is with a private fund manager. The lease terms in Cincinnati, it's 30 years for the meters, 50 years for the garages. In Chicago, it was 75 years for the meters, 99 years for the parking garages. The payment is a little bit different. In Chicago, they got all their money up front, which I think was $1 billion. In Cincinnati, it's this $92 million upfront payment plus the annual payment of about $3 million a year. Rate control in Chicago is private. In Cincinnati, it would be public. Hours of operation are unlimited in Chicago, so they can charge 24 hours a day for parking meters. In Cincinnati, in the downtown area, it would be from 8 in the morning until 9 in the evening, and the neighborhoods would be from 7 in the morning until 9 in the evening.
So it's different.
It's different.
Very different.
So, to wrap things up, with all of this going on, what are we really going to see in terms of just the next couple of weeks? Do you think anything's going to happen while they wait for the judge and the temporary restraining order?
Well, the people who want to put it on the ballot are going to continue to collect their signatures.
Right, and they'll be successful, too.
And if for any reason there would be a lifting of that temporary restraining order, I don't want to say that the city manager is sitting with pen in hand, but if for any reason there's a gap in that TRO, I can imagine that they're going to sign that lease agreement.
And if they sign it, there's no way to pull it back then?
Well, I mean, if there is a gap...
If there's a gap, they sign it.
For any period of time, as long as it would take Milton Dahoney to sign his name, he will do that and put it into effect.
And again, whichever side loses, the court argument will appeal. And right. I've also heard one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs say, they've got other legal maneuvers up their sleeve. So I don't see a quick end to the court action anytime soon.
And they are gathering those signatures right now. They're on their way to doing that. They have to turn those in relatively soon.
They had 1 month from the day the city council passed it, so by April the 6th.
Although
I have heard that they want to turn them in early just to be safe.
Because they have to get them and make sure they're all valid or enough valid signatures to get it on the ballot.
You need 7,500, and they have to be people who live within the city of Cincinnati who are electors.
Thank you both. My head's spinning just a little bit, but I think I understand it all a little better now. Thanks so much for being here.
Okay.
And thank you for listening to Impact Cincinnati and 91.7 WVXU. My guests today were WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. He's covered pretty much every aspect of this parking case, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Archives of our programs are available on our website, WVXU.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier.
Support comes from the Murray and Agnes Season Good Good Government Foundation, encouraging citizen participation in public affairs.